Of course, there was rather more to it than that. There had to be an arrangement to make sure that the cancelling wave was just the right intensity. Otherwise, you might be worse off than when you started. But these are technical details that I won't bore you with. As many of you will recognize, it's a simple application of negative feedback. Just a moment, interrupted Eric Main. Eric, I should mention, is an electronics expert and edits some television paper or other. He's also written a radio play about space flight, but that's another story. Just a moment, there's something wrong here. You couldn't get silence that way. It would be impossible to arrange the phase. Purvis jammed the pipe back into his mouth. For a moment there was an ominous bubbling, and I thought of the first act of Macbeth. Then he fixed Eric with a glare. Are you suggesting, he said frigidly, that this story is untrue? Oh, well, I wouldn't go as far as that, but... Eric's voice trailed away, as if he'd been silenced himself. He pulled an old envelope out of his pocket, together with an assortment of resistors and condensers that seemed to have got entangled in his handkerchief, and began to do some figuring. And that was the last we heard from him for some time. As I was saying, continued Purvis calmly, that's the way Fenton's silencer worked. His first model wasn't very powerful, and it couldn't deal with very high or very low notes. The result was rather odd. When it was switched on and someone tried to talk, you'd hear the two ends of the spectrum. A faint bat's squeak and a kind of low rumble. But he soon got over that by using a more linear circuit. Damn it, I can't help using some technicalities. And in the later model, he was able to produce complete silence over quite a large area. Not merely an ordinary room, but a full-sized hall, yes. Now, Fenton was not one of these secretive inventors who won't tell anyone what they're trying to do in case their ideas are stolen. He was all too willing to talk. He discussed his ideas with the staff, and with the students, wherever he could get anyone to listen. It so happened that one of the first people to whom he demonstrated his improved silencer was a young art student called, I think, Kendall, who was taking physics as a subsidiary subject. Kendall was very much impressed by the silencer, as well he might be. But he was not thinking, as you might have imagined, about its commercial possibilities, or the boon it would bring to the outraged ears of suffering humanity. Oh dear, no, he had quite other ideas. Please permit me a slight digression. At college, we have a flourishing musical society, which in recent years has grown in numbers to such an extent that it can now tackle the less monumental symphonies. In the year of which I speak, it was embarking on a very ambitious enterprise. It was going to produce a new opera, a work by a talented young composer, whose name it would not be fair to mention, since it is now well known to you all. Let us call him Edward England. I've forgotten the title of the work, but it was one of these stark dramas of tragic love, which, for some reason I've never been able to understand, are supposed to be less ridiculous with a musical accompaniment than without. Well, no doubt a good deal depends on the music. I can still remember reading the synopsis while waiting for the curtain to go up, and to this day have never been able to decide whether the libretto was meant seriously or not. Let's see. The period was the late Victorian era, and the main characters were Sarah Stamp, the passionate postmistress, Walter Partridge, the saturnine gamekeeper, and the squire's son, whose name I forget. It's the old story of the Eternal Triangle, complicated by the villagers' resentment of change, in this case the new telegraph system, which the local crones predict will do things to the cow's milk and cause trouble at lambing time. Ignoring the frills is the usual drama of operatic jealousy. The squire's son doesn't want to marry into the post office, and the gamekeeper, maddened by his rejection, plots revenge. The tragedy rises to its dreadful climax when poor Sarah, strangled with parcel tape, is found hidden in a mailbag in the dead letter department. The villagers hang Partridge from the nearest telegraph pole, much to the annoyance of the linesman. He was supposed to sing an aria while he was being hung. That is one thing I regret missing. The squire's son takes to drink, or the colonies, or both, and that's that. Now, I'm sure you're wondering where all this is leading. Please bear with me for a moment longer. The fact is that while this synthetic jealousy was being rehearsed, the real thing was going on backstage. Fenton's friend Kendall had been spurned by the young lady who was to play Sarah Stamp. I don't think he was a particularly vindictive person, but he saw an opportunity for a unique revenge. Let us be frank and admit that college life does breed a certain irresponsibility, and in identical circumstances, how many of us would have rejected the same chance? I see the dawning comprehension on your faces, but we, the audience, had no suspicion when the overture started on that memorable day. It was a most distinguished gathering. Everyone was there, from the Chancellor downwards. Deans and professors were to a penny. I never did discover how so many people had been bullied into coming. Well, now that I come to think of it, I can't remember what I was doing there myself.